This talk was given by Shyla Catherine. For more information and a schedule of her events, visit the Insight Meditation South Bay website at www.imsb.org. For information about online programs, visit the Bodhi Courses website at www.bodhicourses.org. Bodhi is spelled B-O-D-H-I.
I was very excited to write this book called Beyond Distraction, Five Practical Ways to Focus the Mind. I'd been teaching the subject for a few years in online courses, in retreats, in classes. So I had already worked with the theme a number of times. And for quite a few years, I had been enjoying working with it in my own practice because it draws on to two particular discourses from the mid-length discourses. In the discourse called Two Kinds of Thought, which is number 19 in the mid-length discourses, we find a statement that is quite stunning. And it says, whatever one frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of one's mind. I mean, it's stunning because it's so true and we know it to be true. What thoughts do we feed? What thoughts do we fuel? And are we actually using our minds and creating the patterns that we want to live with? Whatever one frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of one's mind. And so the essence of this book is to say, okay, let's look at the patterns that we're creating. What is the inclination of our mind? And is that helpful or is that hurtful? Is it beneficial or unbeneficial? Is it wholesome or unwholesome? The Pali terms are kusala or akusala. And then if we find certain patterns that occur that we realize we do not want this to increase in our lives, maybe we see a pattern of irritation and anger and we think, no, I don't want to perpetuate more anger in my life, then maybe we sometimes need some practical strategies to deal with it when it arises, because those habits occur because we've practiced them before. So just because we decide, I am not going to be angry anymore because I don't want to be an angry person, well, it's nice to have that intention, but sometimes the intention isn't quite enough because there's a momentum. There's a momentum of thought. There's a momentum in the pattern. And so we need different strategies, different practical things we can do, different ways that we can explore that pattern, that we can explore that conditioning, that we can understand, that we can loosen the craving and the clinging that's involved in it, the identification, that we can play with it until we're really able to find a freedom and a release from it. Now, the next discourse in the mid-length discourse is sutta number 20, and it's called the removal of distracting thoughts. And this is a very interesting discourse because it goes through the five particular strategies that I just ran through in the guided meditation and that I took as basically the structure of the book. So the book goes through how to practice with the first strategy of replacing. How can we get good at that? How can we become agile at it? How can we develop the kind of flexibility, that non-stuckness that we have when we're able to replace? The mind is going in one direction and one thought away, we can shift to something else. Can that become easy to do? Can we learn how to do it so that we have that kind of flexibility in the mind? Or are we really stuck in that pattern? We're not stuck. None of us are stuck. But we might have to develop the skill to replace an unwholesome thought with a wholesome one. And the simile that the Buddha used is beautiful. He used a simile, very simple, of a carpenter who has a peg in a block of wood and wants to remove that peg. So he takes a smaller peg and uses the smaller peg to knock out the bigger peg. But because it's a smaller peg, it doesn't get stuck in the wood. So we might shift from an unwholesome thought to a wholesome one, but now we're not clinging the wholesome. We're not stuck there either. But the Buddha acknowledges that that just because we've developed this capacity to replace an unwholesome thought with a wholesome one, that's not necessarily enough all the time. Sometimes it's sufficient. But in cases where it's not, we need a little bit more. And so he moves through this sequence where each step gives us and develops another condition, another skill of mind. And the next step is what he calls examining the danger in those thoughts. And the image that we could use is of the fisherman's hook. And there are discourses where the Buddha talked about this fisherman casting a baited hook into the lake, and the fish that grasps down on that hook. If it only sees the bait, it will grasp down on that hook. It'll bite down on it and come to calamity and meet with disaster. But one who sees the danger, the fish that sees the hook, is not going to get caught. So we look. Okay, that particular thought pattern might be tantalizing. Maybe that fantasy is particularly alluring, or it seems so useful to plan what we're going to do tomorrow and next week and for the whole rest of our lives. Somehow it makes us feel in control. So we have these reasons we justify our thinking. But when we look at the danger, we can look and see, oh, there's a hook there. There might be some tantalizing gratification and pleasure we get from it, from that form of thinking. There's something we get out of it. Otherwise, we wouldn't keep thinking that thought. But there's also a danger. Let's highlight the danger. Let's see what that is. Let's let that danger build the dispassion that helps us want to let go of that pattern of thought, that helps us want to be free of it. And so as we're working with the danger, we're also working with the reward, the gratification that we seem to get from it. We're working with the bait as well as the hook. The simile that the Buddha used in this discourse is of somebody who adorns themselves with like a scarf or like a shawl made out of a flayed corpse. You know, like a rotting corpse of a dog, of a dead dog or of a dead human. I mean, it's kind of a really horrible image. And so this image of the danger, of really seeing the danger, can help us to realize that there are times when we flaunt something as a kind of ornament, not seeing the danger. We're involved in the gratification, the idea of how wonderful it would be to plan this thing to perfection and control it, not seeing the danger of it. We're not seeing things clearly. So it's a very dramatic image, but I think it's an intriguing one. I have the sutta in front of me. I just want to shift the page. The next step, and this sequence kind of just goes through these different steps. And the next step is of trying to forget those thoughts. And we don't start with forgetting them, or we wouldn't be mindful of anything. We don't start with ignoring them, because we need to turn our attention to the thoughts. But there also comes a time when sometimes we realize that by continuing to give our attention to something, we are feeding it. We're not yet cutting through, and it's better to pull back. It's better to withdraw our attention. Maybe we're re-traumatizing ourselves by going over a past painful event again and again. And it's really, the healing would happen if we just kind of like set it down for a while and come back to it later. There are lots of times when we need to have a skillful retreat from our own minds. And we can do that meditatively. We can do that wisely. We can do that very consciously. the simile that the Buddha uses of opening and closing the eyes. Sometimes we see things and sometimes we shut our eyes and don't see them. We can look or not look. Do we have that freedom? Do we have that flexibility? Or are we just drawn again and again into the same pattern? The fourth strategy is to what's called the traditional language is stilling the thought formations of those thoughts. And that's kind of a mouthful, but it's pointing to when we understand the conditions, the causal conditions, when we understand what causes those thoughts, the entanglement, the craving, the clinging, the identification, the basic sense of who I am at the root of so many thoughts about ourselves and about our lives. When we see the underlying causes and how they intertwine and interconnect with feelings and emotions, perpetuating and fueling those thoughts, then it's at that root, at the causal level, deep, that we can experience some profound letting go and stillness. So instead of trying to work at the surface now, we're looking deep into ourselves, into the mind, into the heart, and trying to understand what's going on here. We're not looking into our past, to our childhood. We're not trying to look for anybody to blame, but we're looking at how it is that we continue to get hooked by that particular pattern of thought. Once we understand this, there'll be a tremendous wisdom. I should mention the simile for this investigation, this inner investigation, is of somebody who is walking fast could walk slower. Somebody who's walking slower could sit down. Somebody who's sitting down could recline. And so one substitutes the coarser for the subtler. And it implies a movement from the superficial level of I am thinking about this to understanding the subtle dynamics that condition perception, the subtle dynamics that spark that initial movement of thought. What gets us hooked? What gets us started in a very subtle, very deep way? And when we understand those dynamics, then we won't have any self-anger or hate because we're going to be seeing the causes and conditions as they arise and as they play out. We're not going to be identified. This is my story. This is my pattern. All of that we will have understood and seen through. And so we'll be in a position to be able to bring forth great strength and clarity in determination and resolve to say no to those thoughts without any aversion or anger whatsoever. Too often meditators bring in strength and try to beat up their thoughts too soon. And there's actually aversion there. There's anger. There's a feeling of, I don't want those thoughts. But once we've gone through this sequential process, we can bring forth this resolve without a shred of aversion. And then we are just saying no and meaning it. The image that's used, the simile that's used, is of a strong man who might seize a weaker man by the head or shoulders and beat him down, constrain him, and crush him. So too, with one's teeth clenched and his tongue pressed against the roof of his mouth, one beats down, constrains, and crushes mind with mind. And the mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. I mean, it sounds like we're forcing ourselves to be concentrated, but that's not actually what's happening here. Because of the position of this strategy and the sequence, we already have developed a lot of flexibility of mind. We understand the danger, so there's dispassion towards that pattern. We have reinforced the flexibility to know we have the choice to move towards it and to withdraw from it. And we've understood the causal dynamics, that there are just causes and conditions at play here. It's not all about me and my story and my view and my opinion and my thought pattern and the kind of person I am. We have this real sense that our virtues are stronger than our defilements. And this strong man that beats down the weaker man is aligning ourselves with our virtues and our wisdom. That is stronger than our defilements. And so from that position, we can say no. No to the thought, no to the pattern. No, I'm not going to continue that. And then settle deeply into concentration. So the Buddha offers us these practical steps, and I think they're very fun to work with, actually, in meditation. And I've developed, whole chapters and whole series of practices to develop each one, to really experience that flexibility of mind just by replacing. You know, it could seem superficial, replace one thing with another. But what happens when you actually can replace things? You learn a lot about a thought is just a thought. It's not who I am. There's a lot of insight that comes out of each one, out of each step. And then this particular discourse concludes with the statement, then one is called a master. One is then called a master of the courses of thought. One will think whatever thought one wishes to think, and one will not think any thought one does not wish to think. And when I read that the first time, it kind of blew me away, thinking, wow, I'd love to have that level of mastery over my own mind. To not be a slave of restless thinking, to not be a slave of habitual patterns, but to actually be a master of my own mind. If I want to think a thought, to think a thought. And if I don't want to think a thought, to not think that thought. Just imagine how much suffering in your life would be reduced if you weren't suffering based upon habitual thoughts. Well, first of all, you can eliminate any suffering that's based upon anxiety or views and opinions or comparing or self. I mean, it goes on and on. You would just shed a massive amount of kind of self-condemning or self-limiting thoughts. So these two discourses had become over a period of time a theme that I kept working with in my own practice and that I would also bring into retreats and work with students, because this fetter of restlessness, this habit of thinking, even just the subtle deluded thoughts that don't seem particularly angry or particularly lustful and don't have a very strong story, but nevertheless keep the mind from being concentrated. It's this restlessness that seems to be the primary obstacle to deepening concentration and realizing the attainments of jhana. Sometimes it seems that the mind just doesn't want to stop thinking. So these kinds of strategies actually give us some tools to look very deeply and clearly at the mind, so that we have ways of playing with this pattern, this fetter of restlessness. So this is the basic structure of the book. Five strategies. Well, first, discern if it's wholesome and unwholesome, one of those two classes of thoughts, and then work with the five strategies. And then what I've discovered, which was quite exciting, was when I was teaching this in retreat, was the experiences of emptiness that people had were so apparent simply by working with these strategies. It was shocking to me, because the first few times I was teaching it, I wasn't teaching emptiness. I wasn't talking about emptiness. But so many stories that we have, so many thoughts that we have are all about self, who I am, what kind of person I am, how I want to manifest. Me, 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 me. And when we work with the thoughts and unravel that dynamic of I making and mind making, what naturally comes is not only the profound stillness that enables concentration, but is something even more profound, which is the realization of emptiness, the insight into not self, a clear understanding of how we construct a sense of who we are, our identity, through chronic thinking. And so this sequence, this became very apparent for me when I was teaching a longer retreat. Well, I guess I'm not sure, maybe 10 days, 11 days, 12 days. It could have been maybe even 14 days. I'm not positive how long it was, but it wasn't a short weekend. It was a good length of time. And I was amazed that person, yogi after yogi, practitioner after practitioner, were describing genuine realizations of emptiness. So I thought, this is intriguing. You know, this working with this basic fetter of restlessness, these basic habitual thoughts, could really be a route to abandoning that deeply conditioned pattern of restless thinking. I know when I look at my own mind and I look at the restless thinking, so often it's just this very subtle delusion that's basically thinking about something. And what purpose is it serving? Often it's doing little more than saying, I'm here. I'm going to do this. I'm here. I did that. I don't know if you guys have a similar mind or at times find that many of your thoughts, you know, they just keep over and over saying, popping up to say, I am here. There certainly are times when we need to be able to think, when we need clear reflection, when we need to be able to analyze something, solve a problem, and like really look carefully and creatively at things. So thinking it's not a problem. It's the habitual thoughts that keep us stuck in these grooves. That's where the problem comes in. And we know that in meditation, because very often when the mind is wandering, when it's lost in thought, we're not very happy. And research has shown again and again that the wandering mind is not a happy mind. The happiness comes more from the concentration, more from the capacity to let go, more from those moments of freedom from the conditioned patterns, not from being caught in them. So this process of writing the book was really quite fun. I had a topic that I was enjoying meditating with, and that's always nice to get to write about something that I'm working with. And then the topic that I taught in retreats was blowing my mind, really, to see these experiences of emptiness coming. Because when I first started, I thought it would simply support people's concentration practice, but it went a lot further than that. So that was really exciting to me. And then in addition, I was enjoying a whole new realm in the writing, because people had suggested that I bring in a little bit more of the kind of science research about attention and about focus, because there's been a lot of science studies on attention. And that's not exactly my area of expertise, but it was fun and interesting to consider in this ancient system, I mean, a very ancient system with language like wholesome and unwholesome in it. What did the research support? And where was the overlap with the science? And so there are times when I explain things with personal examples, with examples from students, examples from friends, or examples from science and the research into the mind, the research of brain research and psychological studies. So it was a kind of an interesting process for me to get to combine these different forces in, or these different interests in, the process of writing a book. And I was wanting to write a book. As you know, I've written two other books, and it had been a while, you know, like almost 10 years tends to be between my books, it seems. But there's a process of becoming very clear in writing a book. Be clear about the topic, but also clear in the connection with others. It makes something kind of alive to share it in a different way. And it helps me stay with the topic for a longer period of time than I might in my own practice, because I want to work it in a variety of ways, see how other people work with these things, what happens in their mind when they try these strategies, how can I try it in a variety of times and conditions so that it feels very thorough and deep, which is also something I enjoy in my practice. I like having something to work with and to play with from a bunch of different angles and stay with it for a while to explore it. So for all these reasons, I really enjoyed this process. But I can also say that perhaps one of the other reasons I wrote the book was that not just that I had wanted to write this book, but I needed something to do in the pandemic. I had already had the outline a couple of years before the pandemic hit. I had written the sequence of the chapters. I had written an outline for each chapter. I knew what I wanted to write, but I never had time to write it. And then the pandemic hit and everything was canceled and we were all sheltering in place. So I thought, I've got no excuse now. In fact, I have an opportunity. So the first year of the pandemic, I basically just dove in and wrote this book. And so for me, it's my pandemic project. And even though the pandemic hasn't entirely ended yet, there's still variants of concern around. Nevertheless, as we're starting to get back to what seems like more active and interactive life, it's nice to be able to, at this point, be able to share my little pandemic project with all of you. So I think I said a few things about the book to give you a kind of an overview and an idea of it. I do hope that you will buy the book. It is available at this point now. You can buy it from Wisdom Publications. The publisher gets it first, and it's being shipped to all the various distribution centers. So the bookstores and whatnot are all getting their orders filled first. I know I ordered a couple of cases and I got the notice that they're on the way. So I'll be getting mine soon. But they're available also for pre-order from the bookstore of your choice or bookshop, which is in the chat box. I put up a page that has my three books on bookshop.org. So you can hopefully get it and enjoy it. And I'd love to see you want to work with if you want to work with the topics and the exercises. I put a lot of exercises in the book. Reflect on this, meditate on that, ask yourself these questions, try this, those sorts of things. I will offer an online course at the end in this, starting I think in September, so that we can go through it chapter by chapter together. So anyway, I want to thank you again for coming out and listening to this first presentation on Beyond Distraction, 5 Practical Ways to Focus the Mind.